Welcome to Subject, Object, Verb. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. Today's episode is a study of the musician Arthur Russell. Russell was a cellist, a singer, and a composer, active in the 70s and 80s in Lower Manhattan. He worked under many different names and in many styles, from country to classical to disco. He was virtually unknown in his lifetime, despite his collaborations with some of the most significant artists of that era, including David Byrne, Philip Glass, and Allen Ginsberg. He died at age 40 from an AIDS-related illness. Recently, the writer, artist, and musician Matt Marble published a book about Arthur Russell titled Buddhist Bubblegum. The book focused on Russell's relationship to an esoteric strain of Buddhism called Shingon. For a few years, Marble released a podcast titled Secret Sound, which was an investigation into the many ways artists and musicians have engaged with esoteric traditions, from tantric yoga to theosophy to mysticism. This included musicians such as Julius Eastman, Sister Gertrude Morgan, Roland Kirk, Irma Glenn, and David Lynch. It's a wonderful, wonderful podcast. This year, Matt has also begun The Hidden Present, an interview series whose title and theme song is inspired by Russell's song, Hiding Your Present, and which can be found at Matt's website. In the following conversation, Marble and I discuss the many ways Russell's music expressed his philosophical ideas. He invoked mantras and non-dualistic thinking, and he constructed something that Marble calls the Matrix System, a graphic way of notating music that recalls the many composers who have transformed musical notation into works of visual art. Marble began by talking about the song I mentioned before, Hiding Your Present From You, off the now legendary album World of Echo.
With World of Echo, this 1985 album of Arthur's, it's really kind of the pinnacle of everything that came before it, and of all the different paths that he was on in his life that kind of aligned with this album, which is all him playing cello, singing, and with an effects kind of rack of echo, reverb, and delay and chorus, and the way he works with both the lyrics, the cello techniques, the effects that he uses, even when he performed live and when Phil Niblock did a video recording of it, the lighting also reflected this constant change, this ephemerality that's always at play in his creative process. And so by the time we get to World of Echo, it's in every moment of the music. And that's a big part of Vajrayana Buddhism, Shingon tradition that he practiced, this non-dualistic perspective, this constantly morphing, or more of a single perspective containing infinite views. He would put it in terms of music theory. He said one note, infinite theories, which I loved that quote. But in Hiding Your Present, you hear it in the cello and the effects, the way it's constantly changing. He switches from pizzicato to a smooth bowed playing style. He switches from echo to clean to drenched in reverb to dry. And these changes are happening so fast and so subtly that they can go unnoticed, but it's always this kind of shifting quality. It's like light and water iridescing. And Arthur just became extremely gifted at doing that. And it's rooted in a philosophy from that period that he developed called P ideas, or parenthetical ideas. And this is where he, in his notebooks, would kind of list observations, feelings, imaginative things, musical ideas, philosophical reflections, all in parentheses. And this was kind of a loose philosophy of first thought, best thought, of catching fresh ideas, but also being able to combine them in different ways, to contract them or expand them, to connect them together. And so with World of Echo, he's doing that not only with his lyrics, but with his with the music itself. The music was very mutable. And he captures that in particularly in the lyrics for this song, Hiding Your Present, where he says, where you see where it is, but don't know where it is. And that to me is one of the most perfect definitions I've ever heard of intuition or of spiritual insight. It's an understanding that transcends knowledge, transcends the purely rational observation. That just kind of blows me away every time I hear that song. I love it so much.
Where you see where it is, but don't know where it is. Where you see where it is, but don't know where it is. Where you see where it is, but don't know where it is. Where you see where it is.
Do you think the title of this song, Hiding Your Present From You, refers to this kind of transcendence?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like if you think of, to get too philosophical, but if you think of eternity kind of being hidden in time, or boundlessness being hidden in space or the body, you know, these are the spiritual perspectives that certainly are reflected in Vajrayana tradition. So the present is this kind of eternity that's within you, or within, pervading all things. And it's not that it's ever to be fully revealed. It is necessarily hidden. And Arthur constantly does that in so many ways. One of the most surprising and interesting ways he does that in his notebooks is when he's suggesting musical ideas to himself, he'll say, use pizzicato here or don't. Use different modes colliding here or do not do that. He's constantly proposing something and negating it at the same time. And it reminds me of, there's a Tibetan tradition of a dream yoga where part of the practice is to look around you and constantly identify everything as being part of a dream. So if you take a sip of coffee, you say, I'm taking a sip of coffee in a dream. I'm putting the coffee down on the table in a dream. And that kind of constant reminding oneself of the dreamlike nature of reality, or the ephemerality of what propositions we make, was constantly at play in Arthur's notebooks and in his music. But there's also kind of a personal note with Hiding Your Present I found in his notebooks, where he references a memory from his childhood, and childhood often is a kind of a background for a lot of lyrics. But he talks about a birthday present being hidden for him in the cornfields of Iowa. So he's kind of channeling this childhood memory of walking through the cornfields looking for his present. But it takes on this whole other meaning when you reflect on it from the Vajrayana perspective.
I'm putting everything around you, over by you. From you.
The name of your book is Buddhist Bubblegum, which refers to the merging of Russell's pop tendencies with esoteric Buddhism. What music of his do you think expresses these combined desires?
Well, in a very kind of bubblegum way, you'd have to look to like his mutant disco work with his track like Go Bang or something, where this kind of, lyrically, this cosmic perspective is being combined with a sexual perspective. And these are all in Vajrayana, sexuality is just part of like divine creation. And so it makes perfect sense that those are blended together on the disco floor. And he does it very playfully. And, you know, some of his friends might say that, you know, he was just as much of a kind of a prankster schoolboy giggling and looking out for boys, you know, but it was just a combination of all these things, this kind of schoolboy mentality, this playfulness, this childlike mentality, but also this like profound spiritual ground running through everything. And so in Go Bang, where he's like, I want to see all my friends at once. I'd do anything for the chance to go bang. It's very related to Vajrayana practice, which is all the disciplines, the meditation, the hand gestures, mudras, mantras, mandalas. It's all geared towards immediate transcendence, to immediate connection with the divine. And that's, you can argue the semantics of it, but that's kind of what Go Bang's about.
Thank you for asking your question. You showed us the face of delusion to uproot the cause of confusion. I want to see all my friends at once. I need an armchair to put myself in your shoes.
Oftentimes we assume that the esoteric and the pop world can't really mix, that to be spiritual is to be monastic and to reject culture. But Russell wanted to appeal to the masses.
Absolutely. And a lot of that kind of came through his teacher, Yuko Nonomura. When he was in California, he started studying privately with Yuko, and who was his primary Shingon teacher. And aside from being a Vajrayana Shingon Buddhist teacher, Yuko was also a businessman. And Arthur was kind of blown away by the fact that you could be a Buddhist priest and be a businessman in America at the same time. And that kind of liberated him from feeling like he had to be, that the spiritual path could only exist in a monastic setting and with like complete, just total dedication in that regard. And so he looked to New York and he wanted to make hits. He wanted to connect with as large an audience as possible. And he wanted to make money, not necessarily for him to accrue money, but especially early on, his aim of making money through music was to donate it back to his teacher, Yuko Nonomura, to build a temple, to build a Shingon temple. And I don't know how much of that actually happened, but that was kind of his idea. And, you know, he was wise to realize, and this has, you know, been done throughout centuries, where people are like embedding spiritual messages into popular music. And Arthur, you know, took to the dance culture and realized the ecstatic nature of the movement that was going on in New York at that time. And it was a perfect vehicle for Shingon, for the Dharma to operate.
I wanted to see what makes me go and keep on going when there's no end in sight. I beat in me, I can't go slow, not when it's knowing that you might be back tonight.
Did Russell share his music with his teacher? Was that part of their spiritual relationship?
I don't know if he shared the dance music. I, you know, with Yuko, he was more focused on the instrumentals. They had this collaboration with instrumentals, where it was that whole work was originally based on his teacher's photography of mountains and clouds and flowers in Japan, these kind of revered mountain regions that are revered in the Vajrayana tradition. And he suggested to Arthur that he make music inspired by these images, by these natural images. And that's where instrumentals came to be. You know, there's two volumes of instrumentals. Volume one is almost entirely more pop oriented. So there's a rhythm, there's kind of a rock band instrumentation. And then volume two is very ambient and more orchestral. And, you know, we're talking about Buddhist bubblegum. Like, it's really interesting how Arthur conceived of these two volumes. The first volume being essentially music of the past, more nostalgic, like a bubblegum music, a pop music. And then volume two, you might not conceive of as being pop music, but Arthur proposed that volume two was the pop music of the future. And so he was kind of imagining this abstract ambient music as being the pop music that would play on the radio in the future. But they all, both of these volumes came from the same kind of score. So these different styles emerged from the same kind of root process.
Esoteric practices are usually pretty hidden and occult. They don't offer their secrets publicly. So do you ever feel tension about discussing esotericism so openly?
I did at first a lot more, actually, in part because these are traditionally secret teachings. They're passed down from teacher to student. And so it felt kind of, I felt like I questioned what I was doing at first. Like, am I being invasive? Am I revealing truths that don't need to be revealed? But the more I spoke with people and got to know Arthur's community, the more I learned about esotericism, because this was really my deepest introduction to it, to these kind of vast traditions across the globe throughout history. But there's, you know, since the 60s, the 1960s, there's been this opening up of traditions. And part of that has been kind of leaks in the secret tradition, certainly facilitated by advances in printing and technology. But it's also an issue of these lineages kind of slowly dying out and being kind of compelled to share what they're doing in order to gain followers and keep the lineage alive. And you see that with the Karana Gharana tradition of Hindu raga music, especially in New York, where Pandit Pranath, his teacher told him, go to America and teach this tradition, which is a fairly obscure and mystical tradition of raga, teach it to Americans. And that's where you get Pandit Pranath teaching Terry Riley, teaching Lamont Young, teaching numerous people in New York, especially in the avant-garde community. And so these ideas get transmitted to through American music.
The history of Eastern philosophy entering into Western music has been around for a while, but it's taken on new meaning since the age of Russell and Ginsberg and all the yoga studios popping up in every town. How do you think about Western art engaging with Eastern traditions in this way?
Well, there's kind of two ways you can look at it, in my perspective. One is that it's kind of this gross appropriation of Eastern traditions that is channeled into a commercial capitalist system, which is ultimately based on profit. So not only is it appropriating these traditions, but it's kind of sucking the soul out of them for material gain. At the same time, it's almost like there's no way for these traditions to spread, for their message to spread, if they're not translated into a language that can be readily received by the American zeitgeist. And this is something that, you know, people talk about in terms of like Madame Blavatsky and Theosophy and her repackaging of Buddhist and Indian traditions. I think it's a really complex question and not a very simple answer. You know, I think Arthur, he came to these traditions as a teenager, and it saved him from, you know, he just came out of jail on Valentine's Day after kind of getting wrapped up in maybe some excessive drug use, which was not uncommon at the time. And he was saved by this commune, the Kailash Shigendo commune. So there's a kind of that's a very personal relationship to have with a tradition like that. And I think maybe that might've been one reason Arthur wasn't advertising this kind of connection to the East. You know, he didn't dress up. He didn't appropriate the language. He just didn't advertise his beliefs that way. They were always presented in more abstract, generalized imagery. Flowers, children, light, you know, very, very fundamental things that transcend cultural boundaries. And I think that is something esoterically, spiritually, culturally that's become important to me is trying to conceive of what esotericism is and what spirituality is beyond cultural packaging.
Searching the real face. I'm on another thought now. My eyes searching the real face of an angel. I'm on another thought now.
So a first thought is that kind of thought that arises when the attention is present. And not getting in the way. You know, for most people walking down the street, you would think you kind of dismiss things. You're like, I don't care about that. I'm going to get my cup of coffee. But from a first thought, best thought perspective, you pay attention to what's immediately around you. So this isn't just like thoughts that you're generating. This is like thoughts that are around you as well. But in terms of music and creation, you know, first thought, best thought, it's the freshest thought. It's the one that comes up of its own accord. The one that's not being controlled.
Do you have any thoughts on why he didn't achieve success during his era in the way that many of his collaborators did?
I mean, you know, one of the things that's referred to is that he was constantly kind of changing what he was doing. And I think that certainly contributed to his lack of kind of entering any indie kind of like mainstream, you know, when he's constantly switching his style and sometimes his band names and identities, that certainly makes it a little harder for people to latch on. Whereas you have someone like Phil Niblock or Lamont Young or whoever else who are doing these very consistent aesthetics, developing these long consistent aesthetics. And there is consistency in what Arthur's doing. It just has stylistic diversity. So there's that. And there's also really the gentleness of what he was doing. This is, you know, 70s, 80s New York. We're heading into like punk and, you know, it's post-punk. It's very jaded. It's very aggro. It wasn't a very receptive time for bunny rabbits and flowers and soft sung lyrics, you know? And, you know, not to reduce Arthur to that, but, you know, that was something he was presenting. He was just ahead of the curve. You know, I mean, they say that about these people, but, you know, like even with his kind of World of Echo, you know, now that's kind of like a commonplace. People in their bedrooms recording with their instruments and using lots of effects and or performing with a loop pedal. That's extremely common. And Arthur was doing that before, way before that was remotely common. And it did, there wasn't a place for it. There wasn't a familiarity in the zeitgeist to kind of contextualize it. And so people didn't know what to make of it.
The consistent style problem is a commercial demand that seems to run against the idea of art as a kind of exploration.
That's definitely something I find in one of the more inspiring things I've immediately found with Arthur's music was I loved the stylistic diversity because, you know, people have said like he explored himself more than perhaps most. In other words, he learned different parts of himself. He allowed himself to be fully expressed. And that's something that a lot of us don't do. And I don't know that that's very healthy. But at the same time, you know, there's different personalities that are drawn to that kind of manner of expression. But when it comes to creating, especially when it comes to art, it's like the place of freedom. It is the, to put any boundaries on it feels absurd to me. I think there is a certain kind of personal discipline that one needs to develop. But the idea of aestheticizing or stylizing boundaries, it doesn't float my boat.
I've always enjoyed artists whose work is diverse aesthetically because it requires that I go deeper and discover whatever connections exist beneath the surface.
That's what brought me to the Arthur's archives was, you know, I was reading all these people saying like he never finished anything and, you know, didn't finish anything. Look at all this output that he has out here. And I was like, what is connecting all of this? I know there's something, because I felt this connection in all the music. It didn't feel like random, you know, he'd go over here and then he'd go over there. I was like, I could tell these were all coming from the same place. And I, you know, once I read the biography and realized Buddhism was an aspect, a big aspect of his life, I was like, well, I want to know more about that. I want to know more about what connects these things and what that connection is and what that foundation is. And the more I looked into it, the more I found, and it was beautiful. It's just beautiful.
Now, as you eat, don't think of the one you love. And on the street, don't look at the sky above. Hey, there's no one home. Don't expect nothing, 'cause nobody wants a lonely heart.
Thank you for listening to Subject Object Verb. Like, if you enjoyed the show, please review us or rate us, or force one of your friends to listen to us, or write us an email at subjectobjectverb@artreview.com. To close out the episode, let's listen to one of Matt Marble's tracks, Scintilla A, off his recent album of guitar music, The Living Mirror. Thank you.